All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, and I hope everybody stayed up late getting drunk last night and got to go out and play in the snow. Doesn't get to happen too often around here, so I'm glad I got the chance. And we got a great show lined up today. First up, Gary Nolan. He's running for president as a libertarian. And then at 4 o'clock, G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. So definitely stay tuned for that. Welcome to the show, Gary Nolan.
Hey, thank you for having me on board.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. Why should you be the nominee of the Libertarian Party this year?
Well, because, among other things, I have answered the wasted vote question because we can, if we work together, take command of this election, and you never know what can happen. You could actually have a Libertarian presidential candidate. We can make it happen.
You think you can get in the debates?
Well, I guess everybody makes that promise, and I'm not going to promise that, but I'm going to tell you that we're going to give it 100% effort, and I believe this is our best opportunity ever. We've never had the stars line up for us the way they are now.
In what way are the stars lined up?
Well, one of the big questions, one of the major problems that we've had, especially with Republicans, is the wasted vote syndrome, and I'm sure that libertarians listening are all familiar with this, but for you Republicans, we always hear, gee, I would vote for the Libertarian president, but gee, the presidential candidate might turn out to be the Democratic candidate, and we don't want that. Then we've got an answer for you. All you need to do is look at what happened when Bill Clinton was in office. He had a Democratic president, a Republican legislature, and they were at odds constantly. They fought tooth and nail, and neither side wanted to give. The result? Gridlock. The rate of growth for the federal government was 2.5 to 3%. Well, now you have the Republicans in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. There is no gridlock. The rate of growth minus defense is 7 to 10%. So if you vote for George Bush, you're telling the Republicans, give me more big government. You're saying, I like what you're doing. Give it to me. Keep spending. But if you vote for Gary Nolan, you're going to send a clear message to the Republicans that they are not the party of smaller government. And one of two things will happen. Either you'll have a libertarian president, in which case I guarantee you smaller government, or at the very least, you'll have gridlock again and will have control.
Wow. There you go. So your spin is that we'd be better off with a big government Democrat because actually the Republicans are even more big government than the Democrats are.
Well, when they fight tooth and nail, suddenly the Republicans start fighting for smaller government. They're phonies in that respect, and with all due respect to my Republican friends who are listening, I know you want to believe that your party is the party of smaller government, but they're not. It's the Libertarian Party. So if you really want smaller government, you'll vote for me, and if we have enough momentum, you'll have a Libertarian president. We'll be in the debates, and that'll just embarrass the Democrats and the Republicans. But at the very least, you'll have gridlock, and that's a good thing. Now's the shot. Now's the time to take it. Now's the time to jump on board, to vote for the candidate you really believe in, because you have nothing to lose and everything to gain.
All right, well, let's get into the meat of your platform here, foreign policy first on this show. I want to know your stance on Iraq, and actually, you know what, let's hold off on that. First, I want to know, if you had been the president in 2001, what would have been your constitutional limited government response to September 11th?
Well, I would have gone to Congress for a declaration of war, and I would have gone to war against Afghanistan, because they are, after all, they weren't being ruled by the Taliban government, who were protecting Osama bin Laden. And I think if you are weak in the face of aggression, you invite more aggression. We didn't need to and wouldn't have checked with the United Nations. We would have simply gone to war. That said, there is no reason that I can think of for us to have diluted our forces and invaded Iraq. There just simply was no reason. And while I've been preaching this right from the get-go, we are now finding that polling indicates that Republicans and Democrats, the entire country at large, is beginning to come on board. 50% of the country believe that the war in Iraq was not worth it. And over 60% of the country now believe that President Bush lied or exaggerated about the threat and weapons of mass destruction. So, once again, this is an opportunity for us to do an outreach to at least half the population in this country who believe that this war wasn't worth it. We should not have gone to Iraq.
Okay, now you mentioned that you wouldn't have even stopped to check with the United Nations, and that's a point of view I've been hearing from people like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. So why don't you please differentiate your view on the United Nations from theirs, if you could?
Well, I think the administration has been somewhat disingenuous on their view of the United Nations. First, they went to the United Nations for sanctions against Iraq and the authority to go in there, and of course the United Nations did nothing to protect Iraq or stop us. And now the administration is back there looking for help. The fact is, the United Nations is not, or does not have the authority to rule on sovereign governments, and they certainly don't have the authority to tell us when we can defend ourselves. I wouldn't send a dime of taxpayer money to the United Nations. As far as I'm concerned, they can meet in France.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, we don't need a permission slip to defend ourselves is a line out of the State of the Union from a month ago.
Well, it's good that the president is aware of that. You know, one right and a million wrongs does not make him a good president.
Good call. Okay, so what about the entire, I read something the other day about how really since Truman, this is like a full realignment of American priorities and overseas strategic doctrine and that kind of thing. And I wonder what you think of the new national security strategy of the United States and how yours would be different.
Well, let's first talk about our foreign policy in general, which has been errant since really World War One. I mean, you could actually go back to World War One, the Treaty of Versailles, in which, while we're not signers of it, we certainly did influence it, and we literally created Adolf Hitler. And we created, later on, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, the Shah of Iran. We continue to create our own enemies. We have a military presence in as many as 144 countries. And when I had that data, that was before we sent military into Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Pakistan and others. So we really need to bring the military home. The military is to defend the United States. Not to defend Bosnia or Kuwait or Iraq or Israel. It is to defend the United States. Anybody who feels compelled to defend those countries, and I understand in some cases where you might, buy an airline ticket, get a rifle, and go. But as President of the United States, I don't have the authority to send some other mother's son or daughter to die in your stead. So that's, in a nutshell, where I think our foreign policy has gone astray. We are not the world's police department.
So in the cases of mass genocide and whatever, you don't think the United States should intervene?
No, I don't think the United States has the authority to intervene. If there is a question of national security, then the United States has the authority to intervene. Congress can declare war, we can intervene. But otherwise, we can sympathize American citizens who want to, you know, feel compelled somehow to go and get involved, may do so. But as President of the United States, I don't have the authority to do that. Look, every time we do that, we create our own enemies. Side with Israel, the Palestinians are your enemy. Side with Kuwait, Iraq is your enemy. Let's stop creating enemies.
Now, another effect of this war on terrorism here at home has been the centralization of police power. And it's funny, in my notes here I wrote that I ought to bring up the re-federalization of police power. And I realized that, you know, in common parlance, federalization of police power means to centralize it, where actually the word federalism means decentralization. And, you know, I read something that said there was 18,000 different police jurisdictions all across the United States, and how more and more their computer systems and their command and control systems are being integrated with police at the state level and at the federal level. In fact, there's even a new bill in committee right now it says it in plain as day English that they want to be able to put CIA officers in local police departments. And this is something that I think is very important to people from the left and the right and every other up and down and political persuasion, the centralization of police power. And it didn't start with the Patriot Act.
Well, let's you and I, just so that we can get the Patriot Act out of the way, let's explain a few things. One, there's not one legislator who read it before they signed it. Two, now legislators on both sides of the aisle are talking about tinkering with it. And three, as President of the United States, I'd want it yanked. I'd want it removed completely. Benjamin Franklin said those of us who are willing to, and this is a paraphrase, trade liberty for security will have neither. It's counterproductive. They're using it against ordinary citizens. In fact, I think they've been more successful using it against ordinary citizens than they have terrorists. Let's get rid of it. As far as this combining of all of the intelligence agencies and focusing them on the United States, it's a mistake. First, let's devote our resources to finding and seeking out Al-Qaeda and responding to them. Let's not dilute them. And we waste precious resources in this country on looking to arrest Art Garfunkel for smoking marijuana. I think it's a waste of resources. Let's put those resources toward finding the bad guys. We don't need to spy on Americans. We don't need to take away American liberties. We don't need to tinker with the Bill of Rights. At the end of the day, it's counterproductive, and at the end of the day, I think it'll also cost us our republic.
You said counterproductive a couple of times there. Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, one example is, suppose you're a member of the Middle East community and you see behavior that you think is suspicious. Most Americans of Middle East descent, and let's face it, they're going to be the ones who are going to be in a position to more easily spot behavior among errant Middle East potential terrorists. Suppose you spot this behavior and you want to report it to law enforcement. Well, before the Patriot Act, you could do it, know that law enforcement might investigate, find something, find nothing, and respond accordingly. But today, you'd be hesitant to report it because you know that these people will disappear off the streets. They won't have benefit of an attorney. Their families may not even know that they've been arrested. Well, I think that's counterproductive to inhibit that kind of cooperation. The Patriot Act needs to go.
And as far as... I mean, really, this march towards centralizing police power has been going on since the late 60s, right?
Well, it's wrong. There are very few laws that the United States government... If you're guilty of piracy, counterfeiting, I mean, there are only a couple of laws. The rest of this stuff that we have this massive federal investigative agencies and with arrest powers and guns, simply ought not to be. Local police and states and communities determine what are crimes and under what circumstances they'll be prosecuted and what punishments will be meted out. We need to get back to that.
Okay, let's talk about money. I think every libertarian has a gripe against the Federal Reserve, and the arguments for the solution come down in all different forms. You have total gold standard type folks. You have people who say, well, let's just put the Fed under the Treasury and let the Treasury create the money out of nothing. And some people say repeal the income tax and replace it with a sales tax, and all different kinds of arguments. So why don't you give us, let us know where you come down on these.
I would like to get rid of the Federal Reserve, and there is an economist at a university in the Northeast that I've been speaking with who's trying to work out a way to do this. I wish I could tell you that I can do it and I can do it overnight, but I just don't know that I can. I believe if we work on this, we'll come up with a solution that works, but I don't want to kill the patient with the medicine. I want to get rid of the Federal Reserve. They are a private organization. They are not part of the federal government. And it is the job of the federal government to mint currency. I would like us to get back on the gold standard, but once again, it's not something we can do overnight. We have to be very careful because, again, we don't want to kill the patient with the medicine. So the danger to a fiat currency, much as we have, especially as we continue to print it on a regular basis, is that the only value it has is the value we put in it. And if suddenly we decide that it is not a value, then our entire currency system collapses. The more debt we have, by the way, the more currency the federal government or the Federal Reserve print. And it becomes worth less and less until eventually it's worthless.
Well, so what about the national government taxation? Right now there's the 16th Amendment that says that they can take money right out of my check, apparently.
Yeah, well, I'm of course don't want that. I think the income tax is not just it's not just counterproductive. It's actually cruel. It's like a form of slavery. We need to repeal the income tax. We need to get rid of it. You know, my father was a structural iron worker, and he had to be careful how many hours of overtime he put in because he could net less pay. I think that's atrocious. I think it's horrible, egregious that a federal government would have a tax plan that encourages people to stay in debt. You would think they would want us to be prosperous and debt-free. Instead, we have a tax program that encourages it. We constantly hear about people not saving enough in this country, and yet when they save and invest wisely, they suffer with a capital gains tax. We're punishing. It's like, imagine teaching your dog to sit that way. You know, tell him to sit, and when he does, whack him on the nose. Punish him. He won't sit. Well, we're doing that to Americans every day. We need to get rid of the income tax. I don't particularly favor supplanting it with a sales tax. If there is no alternative, if somehow my hands are tied and I'm forced to make a choice between what I, you know, between the income tax graduated, the flat tax, and the sales tax, I would take the sales tax. But that's not my goal. My goal is to reduce the government to the point where we need no more than the federal excise tax the founding fathers left us with. And if the government outspends the excise tax, they can apportion the debt to the states. So they would send to Texas a bill and say, here's what you owe us. If you want to watch state legislators start screaming for smaller government, wait until they have to collect that money and send it to Washington untouched.
I noticed one of the things on your website there and in your platform, you talked about the best economic plan is letting people keep their money. And I thought, you know, I mean, obviously that's true. But then again, it also brings up the issue of, you know, it almost sounds like supply-side economics and that, you know, the way they talk about it on the news is how do you approve of the government's handling of the economy, when I always thought that that question was kind of moot because that's not the government's job to manage the economy at all.
And, well, you're right.
And I just wanted to make sure that, you know, because the rhetoric sounded pretty close to, you know, a Milton Friedman kind of monetarist supply-sider type, which quite different than the Rothbard school, I think.
Look, the government can't make a hot economy, but it can get out of the way. And that's what it needs to do. It needs to get out of the way. We need to disentangle ourselves from these high taxes and corporate taxes, which, after all, at the end of the day, are only passed on to the poor and the middle class. Let's get rid of them. Let's get the government out of the way so that people can take their money and spend it and invest it as they see fit. And yes, some of them will be foolish. Some of them will spend their money and won't have a retirement. But anybody who's 35 years old or younger and counting on Social Security to be there, they're wasting their money. That's at least 13 or 14% of their gross income that's going to go up in smoke. It won't be there for them. Let's get the government out of the way so the economy can move, and let's privatize Social Security, get the government out of it so that people can decide when to be provident, when to invest, and when to prepare for their own retirement.
Well, you don't support Bush's plan of sort of kind of half-ass privatizing it where the government invests it for you kind of thing, do you?
No, I would suggest that we get the government out of it entirely. The government has no position in whether or not I decide to be provident this week or next. You know, let me tell you a little story. I started a security and alarm company, and when I did, I was working for somebody else. And I was desperately looking for capital to invest in that company, which, by the way, fed and employed several other people. But I was paying an income tax or a Social Security tax, money that I could have used to more quickly build my own company. But the federal government didn't allow me to make that choice. They decided that I would invest in my retirement when they wanted me to. As a result, it took me a couple of years to get that company where I wanted it to be.
All right, let's talk about immigration.
Okay.
Bush just proposed this amnesty thing, which you're not supposed to call it an amnesty, but I guess that's what it is. And, you know, there's a real split in the Libertarian Party, I think, on this issue. A lot of people take the more Republican view that we ought to line up a lot of federal police on the border and keep everybody out. And there are others who are for totally open immigration. And, so I don't know that much about you, so I want to give you this opportunity to lay down exactly where you stand on this.
Well, one thing that we need to do is get rid of the artificial barriers, that the bar that says, gee, we can only take so many people from any country. That's just nonsense. The truth is that we're a long way from full, and that we need to quit putting in these artificial barriers so that we can have people come into this country and produce and consume. And that only drives the economy. It's good for the economy. There's this long silence when I finish. Am I? Do you have any? You know,
well,
feel
no,
free to follow up.
Well, yeah, I'm feeling free to let you go ahead and follow up if you like. I mean, we got plenty of time here, so don't feel like you have to give a short little soundbite type answer. If you don't want, you can kind of go on. I mean, there's a big conflict. For example, I had Mike Badnarik on here, and I've talked to him since then. Which, by the way, he told me to tell you hi. When we talked, he pretty much said, you know, look, individuals are individuals, and they all need to just come right on in, and, you know, we should have a bouncer checking IDs to make sure no felons are coming in, but other than that, let everybody come on in. And when I talked to Aaron Russo, he said, well, that's crazy. First, you got to dismantle the welfare state, because we can't afford all these immigrants coming in here and getting on welfare. So then when I talked to Mike Badnarik again, he said, well, you know, for me, I'd take care of both of them at the exact same time, and then we wouldn't have to worry about it, you know. And so with Russo, it was sort of like, well, he would agree to open immigration if we got rid of the welfare state first, but that getting rid of the welfare state has to come before open borders.
Well, why can't we do this all at the same time? Why can't we say, look, this is it. The system is going to atrophy. We're not going to put anybody else on it and open the borders. I don't see where there's a problem there.
Right.
You know, none of us, I don't think there's anybody who's listening to this program right now that is a bona fide U.S. American citizen that they can't trace their roots to overseas. We are a country of immigrants. And it worked. It was the melting pot. It was what made us the great country that we are today. I'm in favor of opening those doors and letting people in, letting them bring the best of their culture to us. It will keep the best, and we'll come up with the strongest, as we have in the past, country in the world.
Yeah, a lot of past tense there.
Well, I think we have seriously hurt ourselves in the last, I would say in the last 100 years, we've gone the wrong way, and we need to bring it back, and we can.
You know, I saw something in the news last week about how you're second only to John Kerry on the donors at Amazon.com.
Yes. Yes, that's it's been a great outreach for us as well. We've gotten calls from newspapers all over the country. They've been doing stories about man bites dog. And that's essentially what it is. You've got an insurgent campaign that's getting some national interest. It's great for us. It's great for Amazon.com, and it eventually, I think, is going to fuel the start of something wonderful for us.
Yeah, they just started that, right, where you could donate to candidates on there?
They started that about, a couple of weeks ago, I think, maybe 3 weeks ago.
Oh, really? And you already raised, what, $30,000-something off that, right?
No, I think we're at, about $14,000.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We soared right up into first place the night that they started it. And then mysteriously, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it is peculiar, I have to admit, you couldn't donate to my campaign.
Oh,
now,
really?
The same software that everybody else was using, but mine, for some reason, was hanging up, and you couldn't donate. So that night, we slipped into second place. By the next morning, they had it back up and running. And when that happened, we went back into second place. We were in third. We went back up to second, and then we went back into first. And we remained there until Senator Kerry won the primary in New Hampshire.
Right on. Good for you, man. That's pretty good. How are Mike Badnarik and Aaron Russo? Are they on the same list?
Michael Badnarik is on there. He's not doing quite as well. Mr. Russo didn't meet the qualifications, and so he's not on there at all. But you know, Michael's he's a trooper. He's out there fighting for what he believes in, and he'll do fine.
Yeah, I wonder about, to my ears anyway, I'm sure, you know, if I sat you guys down in a room together for long enough, I could find a difference. But, I mean, truthfully, on the issues, you guys don't sound like you have really any differences at all. Maybe it's just a matter of the way you go about it. You mentioned on your website about how, because you're a former radio host and you have connections in the media, that you think that probably put you over the top.
Well, I think that gives us an edge, and the result of that is that through those media connections, I've been able to speak at the Arab American Leadership Conference, something that all the Democrats did, and I did, and nobody else, no other third-party presidential candidate did. I was at College Convention 2004, sharing the same stage, the same day, as the Democratic presidential candidates. And it was, you know, one right after another, Senator Kerry, myself, and then Joe Lieberman. I can get us into those places. I can draw attention to the party, that, and it's attention that we need and deserve. But what you really have to look at, frankly, is the Democrats and the Republicans in their primaries, and right now, of course, we can focus on the Democrats because theirs is an active primary. You'll see that they're all going in different directions. Kerry wants to go one way, Dean wants to go another, Kucinich yet another. It's because they have no principles. They have no core belief system. When you listen to Michael Badnarik and I debate, you'll find that we pretty much agree on everything. You know, there are a few places where we disagree. A little of the minutia goes in different directions. But it's primarily always the same way, and that's because we have principles. We have a belief system. The only difference is outreach. I'm frankly proud of that.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. Although, you know, it's funny because usually I tend to think of libertarianism as a lack of an ideology. I mean, principles, yeah, but, you know, ideology is usually something that's used as an excuse to violate people's rights because it's such a good ideology. And it's kind of funny to me that the libertarians who basically just have one principle, live and let live, it's almost, you know, they're as beholden to that as any communist would be to the to Karl Marx, you know?
Well, I think that having principles and believing in them and willing to stand up and fight for them is a good thing.
Well, what do you think about guns?
What I think about guns? I can think of no better way to protect yourself than to have one in your home. If you're asking me whether or not I'm a fan of gun control, the answer is no, unless that means hanging on with both hands. Gun control doesn't work. It doesn't work nationally. It doesn't work internationally. And frankly, it's the Founding Fathers wanted us to have firearms. They wanted us to have state-of-the-art weapons so that we could protect ourselves. Not so we could go pheasant hunting, so we could protect ourselves.
Individually as well as collectively?
Of course. Absolutely.
Now, you know, if you become president, that you're going to have to convince Congress to repeal 20-something thousand laws just on guns alone, right?
Well, just, you know what, think of me as a designated driver in a room full of drunks. I'll lead Congress.
Yeah, you know, there's only so much you can do by executive order as far as repealing things. I mean, I guess you can order your agents to stop carrying out this or that function, but for the most part, you're going to need Congress to want to go along with you, right?
Just think of me as that designated driver. I'll lead. They'll follow.
All right. Now, hey, you mentioned Art Garfunkel getting busted for weed earlier, and, you know, in reading about you in the last week or so, I found where you used to be a hardcore Republican who only decided to be a Libertarian in the last 10 years, I think. And I wonder, you know, what is it about, you know, when you made the switch from the big government Republicans to the Libertarian Party, I mean, were you for the drug war before then, and now you're against it? Or
Let me tell you the story of this, because I started off as a talk show host up in Syracuse, New York. I used to do the morning show on WHEN, and there was a drug bust. I had the Onondaga County prosecutor with me, and I was doing the typical Republican rant and rave. And I got a phone call from a guy who said he is a former police chief from the town of Tonawanda, New York, and he wanted to come in and debate me on the drug war. Well, I checked his background, and sure enough, he really was. And so with those credentials approved, I thought, I'm going to just chew this guy up. because he was telling me on the air when he asked to come in and debate that he believed that I was wrong and that we should legalize or at least decriminalize drugs. So he came in, and I had done my homework, and I was prepared to eat his lunch. And I want to tell you that there was a lunch eaten there, but it wasn't his. It was mine. There wasn't an argument that I'd heard, read, or understood that held water. He just, plain as day, made it clear to me that I was on the wrong track. He really enlightened me. He really opened up my eyes. And from that time forward, I was a Republican who believed that the drug war was wrong. Subsequently, I ran into more and more libertarians. I used to listen to a guy. I used to engineer a show, actually. I would do my morning show, and then I would engineer a tape-delayed broadcast of another talk show host. And I was listening to his arguments, and they were flawless. They were absolutely impeccable. And finally, he revealed that he was libertarian. And that was when I found out about the party for the first time. His name was Gene Burns, for your listeners who are familiar with him, or who are not familiar with him. Do a web search, find a way to link up to his show, and listen to this man. He is just brilliant. But that's what started me in the direction of the Libertarian Party.
Oh, that's a good story. I like that. It's not too often that people are willing to just say, well, all right, you won, and I was wrong.
Oh, you know, you couldn't. How? I don't know how you could not be convinced. There isn't an argument that holds water. There isn't one argument that you can defend. And believe me, I do this, you know, if you know as a talk show host what it can be like, I do this 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week. At the time, it was the morning show. I was debating. I love to debate. This guy just tore me up. At the end of the day, you've got to admit when you're wrong, and I was wrong.
Well, if he hadn't have been a former police chief and he was just some stoner off the street, would you have admitted defeat so easily?
I would if, well, first, if he were a stoner off the street, I probably would not have put him on the radio program. But I had plenty of opportunities, having interviewed libertarians thereafter, to be convinced. The fact is, he made, you know, just terrific arguments. The logic was sound, and there was no denying it. There was no defending my position. I was wrong. My mother used to say, a smart person changes their mind, a damn fool never does. So I was at least smart enough to realize that I should change my mind.
Everybody, I'm Philip Drew, and this is an interview with Gary Nolan. He's running for president as a libertarian. I found on the internet that you're the former head of a group called the Capital Watch. What's that?
Capital Watch is a taxpayer watchdog group, and they try to monitor the wasteful spending of Congress, and they're in favor of lowering taxes. And so it seemed to me to be one avenue of activism that I could take, besides being a talk show host, that would in some way benefit the country. So I did that for a few years. I'm now on the board of directors with Free the Eagle. Taxes are just, you know, first there's the immorality of it. To tell somebody that we're going to take a portion of your income because a bunch of your neighbors decided it was okay to do that. This is a republic. It's not a democracy. They don't have a right to do that. And they don't know people's individual financial positions on top of that. So how many families do they destroy when they do that? How many children don't get a better lunch? How many families could be living in safer neighborhoods, putting their children in private schools? How much harm are they doing silently to all of these families? Let's get rid of this income tax. How did I get there? I don't know. Every time I think of it, it just makes me cringe.
Yeah, I know. It's really ridiculous. And you look at who passed it. In 1913, it was a bunch of criminals running the Wilson administration who ran the damn thing through. And as far as I know, they never even did get the 3/4 of the states they needed to ratify it. They just claimed that they did and started printing new constitutions with a 16th Amendment on there.
Curious that the wealthy at the time were waving their tax form like it was the red badge of courage. Because they were so wealthy, they had to pay a tax. It was a way of bragging, of showing off. And, of course, now that the tax is affecting everybody all the way down the line, and it's become so horribly expensive, that we're all stuck with it. It was a bad idea to begin with, and it continues to rot away at the Constitution.
Yeah, it's definitely no badge of honor anymore.
No.
I think most people try to not even think about it at all until the week of April 15th, and then they just get it over with and just go back to pretending they don't even know.
They cross their fingers and hope that the IRS doesn't come after them for an audit. You know, I had a security and alarm company before I went into radio, and I sold the company. They later came after me to check on some receipts, and I no longer had the receipts. I had penalties, interest, and principal to pay, and they almost destroyed me. Now, how many other families went through that and weren't able to pull themselves out? It's a horrible institution.
Yeah, it sort of seems like just filing your form, you're sort of incriminating yourself. You know, it's sort of a violation of the Fifth Amendment to mandate that you fill out how much you made and how much they can take from you, isn't it?
Well, I don't quite understand how they can force you to incriminate yourself. I don't understand how they can do that. But I've got a solution for it, and that's to vote libertarian. If you want to live in a better neighborhood, if you want to be able to put your children in private schools, if you want affordable health care, if you want a secure nation, you have to vote libertarian.
Affordable health care, but everybody knows that we won't have affordable health care until they nationalize it and give it to us all for free.
Yeah, like they're doing to the Canadians. Don't the Canadians come across the border in droves to get American health care? We got more MRI machines in Ohio than they have in all of Canada. Nationalized health care doesn't work. Health care drives the cost, federal involvement in health care drives the cost through the roof. It costs an average $900 million to get a pharmaceutical from the chemist's shelf to your drugstore. $900 million. What does that mean for the small pharmaceutical company who wants to compete? They don't have that kind of capital on hand. They can't. What does it mean for foreign companies that want to come in and compete? Few of them have that kind of liquidity either. So what the federal government has done is they've virtually given the pharmaceutical industry, the major corporations in this country anyway, a government-protected monopoly. No wonder they're gouging us. But if you add on top of that the tax burden, because you have to support them, the FDA, and the 10-year delay, it can cost us up to thousands of lives a year. So we're paying for it in our prescription prices, paying for it with our taxes, and ultimately we're paying for it with our lives. There's a better way.
And that better way is just unrestrained free market activity?
Well, you know, what we used to do worked pretty well. The pharmaceutical industry, which, let's face it, has a vested interest in keeping you alive. Once you're dead, you just don't buy as much. They would send their test data to the AMA to vet. They would vet it, they'd send out a press release, and the system was very, very good. It was very effective. It worked. And it didn't cost taxpayers. It didn't have a 10-year delay. It was a good system. There are other things that we can do. There's the underwriter's laboratory model. There are all kinds of alternatives. But certainly this cumbersome, burdensome FDA needs to be removed.
Good for you. I like that, Stan. I'm tired of the FDA myself telling me what kind of seeds I ought not to be eating.
Well, how about the audacity of the Food and Drug Administration telling AIDS patients who went to Japan in the early 80s to find medicine that they had to give it up when they came back into the United States? They actually had, when they would land and go through customs, they had the customs agents seize the medicine. That's just horrible. Let's not let it happen anymore.
It's amazing to me that they can even find somebody to do that job. You know, like the cop shows up at the airport and takes the stuff, you know?
Well,
like his boss told him to.
I used to think the drug war was the thing to do until we sit down and explain it to them. I guess that's, you know, they're doing what they believe is right. Until they have recognized the pathologies that develop as the result of their task, they'll probably continue to do it. And that's the job of the president. You're supposed to use the bully pulpit. You're supposed to lead, and it's time for leadership in Washington. Something we haven't seen, I would offer, in 100 years.
Man, wouldn't that be cool, too, to have Kerry and Bush beaten by a libertarian?
Well, anything is possible. You can look at the Minnesota model and say, gee, anything is possible. I told you about the numbers of people who believe we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, who think it was not worth the cost, and the number of people who believe that it was, that the president lied or exaggerated about weapons of mass destruction. and fully 20% of the Republican Party don't believe we should have gone into Iraq. And they're advocates of small government. And the rank and file are disappointed in George Bush. We get those people on board, and we begin to tip the scales. We start to show up in the polling data. Then you add to it that I would be the only anti-war president left. And we're adding more people to it. And let's talk about our outreach to the Arab American community. Let's talk about an outreach to the left, to the Democrats. You know, the Democrats and their followers, the rank and file Democrats, are no different than the rest of us. They care about the poor and the indigent. They care about the environment, and so do we. But if you look at what the Democrats have done, they've been a disappointment to their constituents. What have they done for the environment? Not much, but we have a solution, and it's rooted in liberty. What about education?
Well, wait, stop right there. Let's get back to education in a second.
Okay.
I want to hear about the solution to the environmental problems rooted in liberty, because, you know, it's everybody knows, quote-unquote, that only a massive federal agency can protect us from polluters in our neighborhood.
Well, interestingly, they don't. You can look at pollution-belching plants all over the country who have been given dispensation by the EPA, which, by the way, has been cited for dumping mercury themselves, and it is the result of legislators who write the rules for the EPA being influenced by the polluters. So you'll see plants that are belching out pollutants that have been grandfathered in, who have been protected by the EPA and by Congress, because the polluters are giving congressmen and legislators money, and those are the people who are writing the laws. So maybe we need to get cleaning up the environment out of the hands of the government, because you wouldn't say to your neighbor, well, you can pollute just up to my waist, or you can hurt me up to the knees. You would say, no, I don't want any of this. So what we need to do then is give the power to protect property to the individuals who own the property. First thing we need to do is go after the biggest polluter. And the biggest polluter is the federal government. They pollute more than the five largest chemical companies combined, but they have sovereign immunity. Well, libertarians believe in personal responsibility and accountability, and I believe that we can take away that sovereign immunity and hold those polluters responsible. Secondly, let's give people who have waterfront property the fishing rights to that property, so that when the guy upstream pollutes, you have recourse. You have the mechanism to hold them accountable.
So, and that mechanism would be civil action.
Correct.
Well, doesn't, I mean, I don't know, is it that much different to have case law precedent type thing than it is to have an EPA?
Oh, I think it's considerably better. I think it's considerably better. If everybody downstream is suing the polluter upstream, that's incentive for the polluter upstream not to pollute, not to harm their property, not to devalue it. I think that influence alone is enough to make a difference. But let's face it, the biggest polluter is the federal government. The whole Love Canal thing is the result of government, not necessarily federal, but it is government. You know, when Hooker Chemical bought that property, the government had dug the trench. It wasn't really a canal. It was just literally a trench for putting in chemical waste. Hooker Chemical was burying that chemical waste and doing it responsibly. Well, the school board said they wanted the property. Hooker Chemical refused to sell it to them. So now the government comes in and says, look, we're going to take it by eminent domain. So Hooker Chemical sold the property for $1 to the Buffalo School Board, and they told them not to build anything on the property. It's actually part of the contract. But, of course, the government ignored it. They started building on the property, and they disturb the chemicals, and now you have the Love Canal fiasco. The biggest polluter is government. Let's get them first.
Right, and Hooker Chemical's the one that got stuck with the bill for that one after the government went and screwed it up, too, right?
Pathetic, yeah.
That's crazy. Okay, now, when I interrupted you, you were about to get to education and the left. How you're reaching out to left-wingers on issues like education.
Well, because they do care. You know, I don't want to slam the door in the face of Democrats because they care about these issues. They care about education, and their party has told them repeatedly that they are, quote-unquote, the party of education. And yet 50% of the kids who graduate from public schools today are functionally illiterate. Half the kids. In Washington, D.C., it costs between $10,000 and $15,000 per student to get them through school, and they have the worst record of all. So clearly the party of education is not doing a very good job of educating. Every major metropolitan area in the country, the Board of Education is controlled by the Democrats. They're not doing their job. So let's find a better solution. The first thing I would suggest we do, and as a candidate for federal office that I would do, is end funding of the Department of Education. It's 3%. That's all it is, 3% of the public monies that go to school from the federal government go into schools. So it's not going to be a horrible dent to their pocketbooks. And it releases, at least at the state and local level, for them to take care of their educational levels and how they want it to, what kind of curriculum they want. Personally, if I were running at the local level, I'd be pushing for just private schools and homeschools because they are successful.
Well, you know, the reason left-wingers cringe when they hear private schools is they think of these, I guess they call them, I think the company's called Edison, and basically they just come in and run a former government school and run it pretty much in the exact same way in it, like a big corporate model instead of a big government model. And, you know, I don't think that's, I think most left-wingers, the reason that they would flinch at the idea of privatizing school is that's what they picture is a giant corporation coming and using their school for whatever business purposes.
If that model is successful, I don't think that would scare them. I think what really scares them is they're afraid that some parents wouldn't have the funds to send their children to private school, and that a lot of kids would fall through the cracks. I think that's their biggest concern. And we can show them how parents getting a gross paycheck would increase their capacity to put their kids in private schools, and how the competition would make people strive for excellence. You'd get the best value for the dollar if people had a choice of what school to send their children to. And I think we could demonstrate that those models work well in the education department. You know, who wants to send their kids to a school that's graduating kids that can't read? You wouldn't. They'd be out of business. There's an accountability and a responsibility in the private marketplace that the public schools cannot duplicate.
Okay, now I just want to address this really quickly, because truthfully, I don't even care, and it's pretty much a non-issue to me, but it's been in the news so much lately. I got to let you address the gay marriage thing.
The only reason that this is an issue is because the government's involved in it. Let's get the government out of it. You know, the institution of marriage is primarily a religious institution, not a government institution. You don't need a license if you're a Catholic to get a to make your first communion. Why should you need a license to marry? You know, you don't need a license to have your bar mitzvah. Why should you need a license to marry? So let's privatize Social Security, get the government out of it, and now you can marry whoever you choose.
So is that the loophole? That's their excuse to giving you a license is the Social Security thing?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things. First of all, there's the tax problem, which, of course, we would correct by getting rid of the IRS.
Right.
Then there is the health care benefits, and that is a result of the taxes. Back in the 1930s, early 40s, Franklin Roosevelt had put in a wage and price freeze. And then he told employers that you could give employees health care in lieu of a pay raise. So it suddenly became the venue of employers to provide health insurance. Well, if you undo all that and it becomes the venue of the individual to buy his health insurance just like his car insurance, it brings the prices down. Health insurance companies cater to individuals instead of corporations. And you don't have to worry about whether or not you're buying insurance for somebody's buddy or for somebody's lover. That's part of the problem. Let's get the government out of it. Privatize Social Security, you take out your own retirement plan, and you invest and you name whomever you choose as a beneficiary. Suddenly you don't have to worry about whether or not there are Social Security benefits being bestowed upon a stranger, a friend, or a lover. It's not the government's job.
So in a case where, say, you know, someone's in need of medical attention, normally a husband or a wife is in the position where they can give permission to operate or whatever like that. So as far as a gay couple, that would just simply be a matter of contract between them?
Certainly. It'd be the same religious contract that there is between heterosexual couples. And lo and behold, the hospital that doesn't honor that, I wouldn't want to be their attorneys.
So you think your position on this is going to alienate a lot of conservatives?
No, I don't think
so. Really be backlashing against what's going on in Massachusetts.
Well, I think when they understand that it's government benefits that make this such an issue, and that by reducing the federal government and government's interference in people's lives, it becomes a non-issue. We don't care if homosexuals live together. Why should we care if they marry?
Yeah, I sure don't. And it's going to be funny, you know, I'm going to have Bob Barr on next week, and I hope we don't get sidetracked onto this topic for too long, but, you know, I heard him on the radio saying the people should decide, and I thought, yeah, exactly, but which people? You know, the 51% in the neighborhood or the two individuals that we're talking about here?
Yeah, I was on his show not too long ago. He's actually broadcasting from the same network I used to broadcast out of. He's a pretty nice guy, and I think you'll enjoy him as a guest. You may not always agree with him, but you'll enjoy him as a guest.
Yeah, I know. He's really conservative, but, you know, I remember in his career in the House of Representatives that he was always on the I don't want to say the fringe, but he was outside of the Newt Gingrich establishment in the Republican Party there.
So it'll be good. I'd like to hear that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
I want to thank you for inviting me.
Everybody, Gary Nolan is running for president as a libertarian. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
In May.
GaryNolan.com.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
You have any closing comments? Anything people ought to know about you before we cut you off here?
They just need to remember that if they want smaller government, they need to vote libertarian. And they have nothing to lose. Because even if we tip the hand of the Democrats, we have gridlock. And that's a good thing.
Yes. Let's pray for gridlock. Thank you, Gary Nolan. Have a good day.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.